He was recommended to us by Laurie Worley. Said he's one of the best speakers she's ever seen, really. So we are going to be talking about what?
The Great Depression and the Dust Bowl.
Ah, okay.
I was going to say, I was hoping that somebody was around during the 1930s, but you've all disappointed me. You're way too young, so.
What you say? 1930s. You had trouble with your eyesight, don't you?
Good morning.
You come to the right place.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is John Horrigan, and it's a pleasure to speak before the Amesbury and Newburyport Low Vision Group here at the Salvation Army Building in beautiful Newburyport on this wonderful July summer day. It's a pleasure to be here. I study four different elements of history: historical weather, historical astronomy, historical fires, and a historical economy. And two of these elements, historical weather and a historical economy, play into today's talk. I'm going to be reading to you from three books today, and if time permits, I'm going to bring you a personal story of a family who lived during the Depression and the Dust Bowl, and then afterwards I'd love to hear some of your memories from that time period. But to start off today, I'm going to be reading about the Great Depression out of American Disasters from Ballard C. Campbell. Don't worry about the images up on the wall. They're random. They're associated with the lecture. If you don't see them, trust me, they'll be able to hear me. Don't worry about it. You know something? What we're going to do is we're gonna just turn that off. How's that? That way, it's not an issue.
Yeah,
I'm
not missing a thing.
There we go. Force you to listen. 1933, the Great Depression. The Depression of the 1930s was the worst economic collapse in American history. The Depression began after the great stock market crash of 1929, deepened year by year until the economy hit rock bottom in 1933, and lingered throughout 1939. Americans didn't get fully back to work until the nation fought in World War II, which triggered a tremendous demand for military goods and agricultural commodities. During the 1930s, hundreds of thousands of businesses failed, and millions of families skimped on reduced income, and some had nothing at all. Many individuals never recovered from the psychological stress that came with unemployment, the loss of their property, or the deep sense of gloom that had pervaded over society during the Depression years. The rupture of the economy and the social crises that it caused put tremendous pressure on government to lessen the social and commercial distress. Out of this political crucible emerged the New Deal, the collection of laws and policies associated with the first two administrations of President Franklin D. Roosevelt from 1933 through 1941. This created a new role for government. The causes of the Great Depression are complex and continue to generate debate among historians. By most measures, the nation's economy was robust during the 1920s, when industry turned out growing numbers of motor vehicles, washing machines, light fixtures, and other items for the emergent consumer-oriented society. Firms such as General Motors and General Electric not only became household names, but also sources of financial investment. Shares of stock in large corporations traded on the New York Stock Exchange and other financial markets, where a speculative boom in stock prices occurred the year before in 1928 and in 1929. For many individuals and institutions, including banks, the stock market offered a get-rich-quick plan. Individuals sank millions of borrowed dollars into stock purchases, hoping to reap a profit after repaying their loan. Rising stock prices worried the governors of the Federal Reserve Bank, who tightened credit in 1929, hoping to slow the speculative fever. The bank's action contributed to the stock market crash that began on Black Tuesday, October 29, 1929, although no single event has been pinpointed as its precipitating spark. Billions of dollars were wiped out within months as the values of stocks declined, losing one-third of their value. The worth of some firms shrank far more. Several generations of Americans assumed that the stock market crash was the principal cause of the Great Depression. President Roosevelt said as much in his inaugural address on March 4, 1933, in which he blamed the practices of unscrupulous money changers for the economic crises that gripped the country. But economic historians now doubt that the meltdown on the stock market was sufficient in itself to account for such a severe and prolonged economic decline. They point to contributing factors such as economic troubles abroad, President Herbert Hoover, who took office in March of 1929, believed that the Depression was largely of foreign origin. According to this reasoning, World War I had ensnared England, France, Germany in debilitating debts and reparation payments. American loans became crucial to the maintenance of this unstable financial situation. The crash dried up American credit and triggered an implosion of the world financial markets. When credit tightened in Europe, foreign orders for American goods declined. Within several years, depression spread around the globe. Other factors contributed to the economic slowdown. Congress enacted the Smoot-Hawley Tariff of 1930, which raised the rate of import duties and triggered retaliatory actions from other countries, which lowered American exports. Like the stock market, banks were lightly regulated. Some institutions had speculated in the stock market with their depositors' money. A banking crisis late in 1930 hampered the ability of firms to borrow money and slowed down business. Banking crises in Austria and Germany in 1931 further undermined confidence in the economy. And in September of that year, the Bank of England abandoned the gold standard by devaluing the pound. The governors of the U.S.'s Federal Reserve banks, however, rallied around the gold standard. Slow to recognize the emerging catastrophe in the world economy, they resisted a reduction of interest rates at a time when the expansion of credit might have rekindled business growth. And there's somebody rapping at the door. I'm going to let him in. Oh, you got in. Nice B&E. In 1932 and early 1933, just before Roosevelt took office, the United States had its own disastrous banking crises when panicky depositors mobbed financial institutions to cash out their deposits. Many banks were unable to honor these commitments and went bankrupt, sometimes wiping out a family's entire savings in the process. Roughly 4,000 banks closed their door between 1929 and 1933. Finally, the actions of the Hoover administration, 1929 to 1933, probably helped a modest commercial slowdown grow into a major economic crisis. President Hoover was unwilling to orchestrate aggressive federal intervention into the economy, actions which may have countered the negative psychology that deepened as the conditions worsened. The actions he did not approve, such as the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, a loan program in 1932, were too little too late to stem the magnitude of the economic earthquake. Whatever its causes were, the Great Depression presented the United States with a crisis. Because the word had negative connotations, many contemporaries avoid using the term crisis. Republicans and members of the Hoover administration were less willing to acknowledge the scale of the malaise than were the Democrats, including Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was governor of New York at the time prior to assuming the presidency. In his inaugural address in March of 1933, Roosevelt referred to the United States as a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world. The economic situation, he said, constituted a crisis which justified his request for extraordinary powers to wage war against the emergency. Adolph A. Burl, an aide to FDR, thought that the new administration had a 50-50 chance of stimulating recovery or they would face revolution. At his second inaugural address in 1937, Roosevelt said that the government had the capacity to protect its people against disasters and should use this power to overcome economic epidemics. This sense of crisis was visible in the way national officials viewed their governing responsibilities. During his first 100 days in office, FDR sent a raft of proposals to Congress to fight the Depression. The Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933, centerpiece of Roosevelt's effort to help ailing farmers, was entitled An Act to Relieve the Existing National Economic Emergency by Increasing Agricultural Purchasing Power. FDR told his agricultural policymakers that if farm prices didn't improve, the country stood a chance of witnessing an uprising or serious social disorders in the West. Henry Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture, defended the law's grant of extensive new power to the executive branch on grounds that the emergency demanded swift action. The administration's main effort to rekindle economic growth, the National Recovery Act of 1933, also drew on the language of crises for its justification. In 1935, the Supreme Court rejected the administration's argument that the grave national crisis and extraordinary conditions sanctioned the transfer of broad new powers to the government and the act, and it declared it unconstitutional. Historians have also freely used the term crisis and its synonyms to characterize the 1930s. Studs Terkel, whose Hard Times collects personal stories about the difficult decade, called the Great Depression a disaster and a holocaust. The hard times caused a personal crisis for many individuals. The business slowdown led firms to lay off workers. Bankrupt companies discharged all of their employees. At the Depression's worst in 1933, nearly 13 million people were out of a job, representing about one-fourth of the workforce. In Chicago and Los Angeles County, the unemployment rate approached 50%. Some industries became nearly dormant during the early 1930s. The young African Americans and other non-white groups, women and the least educated, registered the highest rate of unemployment. Joblessness not only reached broadly into society, but it persisted. The rate of unemployment for non-agricultural workers reached 37% in 1933 and had fallen only to 21% by 1940. A study of the unemployed in Massachusetts found that 63% of the unemployed in 1934 had been out of work for a year or more. So at this point, that's just a flavor of what's going on with the Depression. You've got an unprecedented stock market crash. You've got high unemployment, people losing their homes and their possessions. And then a perfect storm literally is brewing in the Midwest. And that's what I'd like to move to right now. It's called the Great Dust Bowl. I'm going to read from the book Great Disasters by Reader's Digest. It's called Drought and Despair in Mid-America. Nation's breadbasket becomes its dust bowl. The Sunday service at the Methodist Episcopal Church in Guymon, Oklahoma, ended on April 14, 1935, as it so often did. And just as a reader's note, in Dodge City, Kansas, 700 dust storms were recorded in a 10-year period from 1930 to 1940. There were three major black blizzards that took place during that year, during the decade. The famous is the, what I'm going to tell you about is the famous Black Blizzard of April 14th, 1935. There's also the Dust Blizzard of November 11th, 1933 in South Dakota, and the May 9th, 1934 Black Roller along the Great Plains. That said, the Sunday service ends on April 14th, 1935, with a prayer for rain. All across the state's western panhandle, again we're talking about Oklahoma, and far into the brown, flat distance beyond, the sun glared down from a cloudless azure sky, heralding yet another hot and dry day. And just so you know, as I mentioned, the height of the Depression was between 1932 and 1933. Well, the next year, the next 3 years, 1934, 1935, and 1936, had unprecedented hot summers in the Midwest. And there was arid conditions and a lot of drought conditions. They just didn't get rain. They got a lot of sun. Unlike today, where we're getting a lot of rain and no sun. So seemingly endless fields of wheat, the region's economic mainstay, were withering in the heat. And the soil was turning into powder. Just another note is that farmers, there were 5,722 farmers in the Midwest in 1890. 20 years later, there were double that amount. In 20 years after that, there were quadruple that amount. So a lot of people were preying on the soil, using the soil, and they didn't know how to turn over the soil to reuse it year to year. The soil was turning into powder. Unless rain fell, and soon, there would be no harvest. More farms would fail, more banks would foreclose, and the area's desperately hard-pressed residents would sink even deeper into misery and despair. Toward mid-afternoon that Sunday afternoon, which was April 14th, 1935, the sky began to darken as a gigantic black cloud rolled in from the northwest. This dense, dark wave of fast-moving turbulence, more than 1,000 feet high and stretching from horizon to horizon, reminded some people of the smoke from an oil fire. To others, it looked more like a rolling mass of muddy, cascading water. The wall of darkness, however, contained not a drop of moisture. What it carried was dust. Untold tons of prairie topsoil lifted from bone-dry fields and swept across the region in a choking, blinding storm of destruction. For nearly 4 years now, in the windy months of winter and the early spring, periodic dust storms had been raging across America's Great Plains. The dusters clogged traffic, derailed trains, buried fence posts, and alternately denuded fields and smothered crops. People had long since learned to stuff rags into window frames and drape wet sheets across doorways to keep the dust out. and they regularly tied damp handkerchiefs over their nose and mouth in order to breathe. Even so, most agreed that the Black Blizzard of April 14, 1935 was worse than anything that they had ever experienced. The storm had blown up in eastern Wyoming, then gathered momentum as it moved south through Colorado and into Kansas. It blustered into Dodge City, Kansas at 2:40 in the afternoon, bringing 60-mile-per-hour winds in a 40-minute period of sudden inky darkness. So thick was the gloom in liberal Kansas that a lighted match held at arm's length disappeared from view. Said Lila King, who was age 11 at the time in liberal Kansas, "I was sure that I was going to die." Rolling on southward, the blizzard sped through Guymon, Oklahoma at more than 80 miles per hour. It then halted a funeral procession near Boise City, Oklahoma, and sent blinded motorists careening off the road in Amarillo, Texas. People huddled in cars, under wagons, in cellars and well houses, wherever they could find shelter until the worst gusts passed. To one storm victim, the gritty darkness seemed to signal the end of the world. Another declared that the nightmare is becoming life. And so it was. The vast open landscape of the Great Plains had always been prone to cycles of rainfall and dusty drought, with the southern sector of the plains, centered roughly on Guymon, Oklahoma, particularly vulnerable to damage. But nothing in anyone's memory approached the punishing conditions that now gripped the region. Recurring crop failures, coupled with falling farm prices and a nationwide financial collapse, had ushered in an era of poverty and disruption that exceeded everyone's worst fears. As an Associated Press report on the April 14th Black Blizzard declared, the entire region had become a dust bowl. The area hardest hit by the drought was the dust proper. The dust bowl was a 97 million acre expanse of prairie and scrubland that encompassed southeastern Colorado and northeastern New Mexico, western Kansas, and the panhandles of Texas and Oklahoma. That's roughly about the size of New England. Government surveyors trekking through the area in the early 19th century had noted its general bleakness. They dubbed it the Great American Desert and declared it unfit for agriculture. But the cattlemen and farmers of a growing America thought otherwise. Vast herds of cattle grazed the regions in the years before the Civil War. Then, beginning in the 1870s and 1880s, as the railroads pushed west, homesteaders moved in by the tens of thousands, lured on by government promises of free land and by the introduction of a steel plow that could easily break the stubborn prairie sod. The population of western Kansas increased fourfold during the 1880s. There was a 300% increase in the Colorado Plains and a 600% rise in the Texas Panhandle. So as you can see, people are moving into this area and they're farming it and abusing the land. The newcomers coped as best that they could with the hazards of the climate. When a dry spell in the mid-1890s brought on major crop failures, a number of farmers pulled up stakes and headed back east. But new settlers soon took their place and stayed on to weather new cycles of rainfall and drought. An unusually moist period began in 1914, coinciding with the outbreak of World War I in Europe and a burgeoning demand for wheat to feed the troops. Area farmers readily filled the need. A new type of mechanized farming was taking hold on the plains, enabling farmers to increase production dramatically. Vast new fields were carved from virgin prairie. By 1920, more than 17 million acres of plains land had been brought under cultivation and were producing a giant share of the nation's wheat crop. The new mechanized techniques were so fast and efficient that farmers soon faced an unexpected problem: overproduction. Demand dropped after the war, and excess wheat became a glut on the market. Prices fell, and to make up for the lost income, the farmers opened up still more cropland. When boom times returned in the late 1920s, another 5 million acres had been cut by the plow. By 1930, most of the nation was skidding into a severe economic depression, triggered by the stock market crash on Wall Street the previous October. But the farmers remained relatively prosperous. The main problem that winter, in fact, was not drought but floods brought on by heavy rainfall. So they're having drought in the growing seasons and flood in the winter seasons. But soon the rains began to dwindle, and then the dust began to fly. The decade's first dusters blew up in the Texas Panhandle in late winter and the early spring of 1932. Limited in extent and causing only minor damage, they proved mere curtain raisers to the coming tragedy. Showers fell in April and May, dampening the soil and temporarily settling the dust. But the weather worsened as the months wore on. Searing winds alternated with sudden cloudbursts and severe local flooding. Hailstorms flattened large sections of the wheat crop. Armies of cutworms attacked the rest of it. Yields that summer plummeted to 5 bushels per acre. Herds of cattle died of suffocation or starved to death in dust-smothered pastures. Conditions soon slid from terrible to catastrophic. The worst dust blizzard in years slammed into northern Texas in early 1933, the first of 139 such storms to ravage the panhandle that year alone. Billows of wind-driven dirt rolled across the fields, piling like snowdrifts against barns and outbuildings. And the drought was spreading, with the region of dryness extending to Arkansas and north where the plains were normally moister. In mid-November of 1933, the largest black blizzard yet blew up in the Dakotas, darkening the sky for several days and sending a dust cloud thousands of feet into the air, where the prevailing winds carried it all the way to the Great Lakes and the Mississippi Valley. It snowed, incidentally, red snow, I've been told, in New England in 1934 and 1935 due to the dust that was carried eastward. Do you remember seeing that? Any toward red tint? Okay, that's just a data point. We'll talk about that in a second.
I know there was a big snowstorm, but I didn't see it red.
Okay, so...
I was in Watertown, and I was up to my hips walking to school in the snow drift.
Huh. What year was that? What year was that?
36 or
35. 35 or 36, okay.
Okay.
The farmer's plight grew even worse in 1934. Giant dusters ravaged the plain all through the spring, climaxing in a 4-day mega blizzard that began on May 9th and rolled across the wheat belt from the Dakotas to Texas. The storm clogged rail lines and disrupted air travel as far east as Chicago. The wind, howling at speeds of up to 100 miles per hour, scoured the powdery topsoil down to hardpan and carried it east to sprinkle the Atlantic seaboard. The sun grew dim over Baltimore and New York, and in Washington, D.C., a thin film of Great Plains dust settled on President Franklin D. Roosevelt's desk. As wind and sun continued to pummel the plains, the human toll began to mount. While few perished in the storms themselves, the constant inhalation of airborne dust was bringing on an epidemic of respiratory illnesses, bronchitis, strep throat, and most of all, a catch-all ailment known as dust pneumonia. The Red Cross opened 6 field hospitals in the Dust Bowl states and distributed thousands of dust masks to cope with the emergency. Even worse than sickness was the drought's economic fallout. As crops failed, farmers were unable to pay off their loans that they had taken out to expand their holdings or to purchase expensive new equipment during the good times. Banks were compelled to foreclose on mortgages, thus forcing thousands of farm families off of their land. Small businesses, from grain stores to pharmacies to tractor dealerships, closed down. Their services were no longer needed. Finally, the banks themselves went under. Displaced from their farms, family after family decided to flee the miseries of the Dust Bowl. In battered pickup trucks, in Model A Fords, piled high with meager possessions, most headed west for California, where the land was still green and opportunity might beckon. By 1936, the migration had swollen to a flood, with one survey reporting that 1 out of every 4 farmsteads had been abandoned. All across the Dust Bowl, wind-battered buildings stood silent in the empty brown fields, their windows gaping and their doors swinging mournfully on rusty hinges. In all, 500,000 people moved west from the plains during the 1930s. But what they found in California was not much better than what they had left behind. The majority could get work only as laborers on huge corporate farms, harvesting lettuce or grapes or whatever else the season dictated, and living in ramshackle packing crate communities without heat or plumbing. To West Coast residents, they were Okies, no matter what state that they had come from, and they were far from welcome. The diehards who stuck out the drought in the Dust Bowl fared somewhat better. "I could have left here wealthy, and I'll be damned if I'm going to walk out of here broke now," announced one Guyman, Oklahoma farmer. His decision proved to be a wise one. for an array of government agencies swung into action, providing food and clothing, lending money for seed, fodder, and fuel, and setting crop quotas. Soil conservation specialists moved in to study ways of combating the drought. Destructive practices, such as overgrazing, were singled out for correction. And after the harvest, farmers were encouraged to plow the stubble under and thus enrich the soil, instead of burning it off like they used to do. A new method of plowing, with deep furrows cut in at right angles to the prevailing wind, helped trap down wind-blown soil. And the Civilian Conservation Corps planted thousands of trees to serve as windbreakers. The new techniques helped, but recovery was slow. In 1935 alone, at the height of the drought, the Dust Bowl had lost a staggering 850 million tons of topsoil. A single storm that year was said to have scooped up twice as much earth as would have had needed to be filled with the Panama Canal. So in other words, as much soil was moved in a single storm, 850 million tons, as it would take to fill the Panama Canal. And the drought continued through 1936 and 1937. Which added to the tragedy of a grasshopper plague that destroyed much of an already scanty crop. So throw in some grasshoppers in 36 and 37, you get the depression, you got the hot summers, and then the grasshoppers come, the locusts come.
Wonderful.
Gradually, however, in county after county, the rains returned, and the 1938 harvest was the best in years. And that winter, the heavens opened up in a succession of slow healing downpours that soaked deep into the prairie soil. After 8 years of choking dust and weary desperation, the drought was over. Dust Bowl, the Texahoma Times jubilantly proclaimed, is a term to be discarded and forgotten. They called it the Dirty Thirties, and in the worst of times, the wind-driven dust sandblasted leaves from trees and formed 30-foot-high drifts. Farmers were forced to dig out in a futile attempt to restore a semblance of order to their ruined lives. Cattle ranchers, too, suffered as livestock suffocated or starved in barren pastures. So those are the first couple of stories that I wanted to read to you about the Great Depression. Does anybody have any comments up to this point, any remembrances of that nature in regard to the 1930s?
I just remember being poor. I don't think we had any of that death that you're talking about. But I know that my mother and father had five small children. And we were poor, but hey, we didn't know any different. We thought we were great, you know?
Yeah. Everybody else was the same way.
We managed with what we had, and we had me downs, and
we got along fine.
Yeah.
We didn't know what anything was going on.
I remember my father trapping rabbits and shooting my cousins and
yeah.
things
right?
like that.
Really?
Oh.
Really, trapping rabbits.
Well, we were poor, we didn't even know her, you know.
Yeah, but the kids nowadays, I mean, they wouldn't be able to cope with that.
Well, they're so used to stuff.
They all have to have designer clothes now.
Oh, it's a totally foreign. Oh, we're not even going to talk about today. I mean, your era has lived through not only a depression, but you've lived through the last great hurricane to hit New England. You've lived through two wars.
And the flood.
It floods, right, the flood of 36. So what you see, and what I call it is abundance on demand. And unfortunately, and I hate to say it, and you've seen it before, all of that's going to go away, and it's going to go away overnight where you're going to see you're not going to be able to have this, that, or the other thing at an instant. Because as the economy suffers, and I tell people we're about in the bottom half of the second inning of this thing. I think you're going to look for another 10 years, and you're going to see the American...
The year I got married.
Really?
The hurricane.
1938. So, does anybody remember sunsets being beautiful back then because of the dust aloft? Does anybody remember that?
I always thought sunsets were beautiful.
I wasn't near the beach, so
yeah. Can I ask you this? What was, now, being poor and you didn't know any better, did you have a candy store where you used to go in and wish for? Did you have a store that you wished to have a certain toy? Yes, sir.
I used to buy fudge.
We had a candy.
Used to have fudge, and if it was fresh, you would get one piece. If it's stale, you got two pieces for a penny.
For a penny.
And it tastes just as good.
Wow. Sure it did, sure.
And the other one was, I'm sure all these people know, is Nucca, which was a commissary where everyone went to get food and clothes, and they're all passed out.
Really?
All the kids in school wore a certain color.
Yeah.
My brother back then,
you knew where they came from.
Yeah, and everyone knew where they came from.
The government never give you any money in them days. They only give you food and stuff.
Yeah, food.
Today they give you money.
Yeah. They didn't have the money.
They made you come out and get that food, huh?
Huh?
Do you remember soup lines? Do you remember seeing soup lines, and what was your reaction? What were you told when you saw soup lines? Just when you saw that type of humanity lining up just to get something to eat, what was your reaction? Do you remember that? I know you were all children, but anybody?
I remember the trucks coming around. They gave cheese and things like that. They always sent us kids to get it. And everybody in town would be out seeing who was getting it.
Embarrassed.
Would they come by with a truck or something? And people would they come by like with a truck?
Well, they come by and they'd stop like in the center of town.
I see.
Like New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted the free stuff would go get it.
Yeah. My father was in the...
they always made us
bread business.
Yeah, the kids went. Kids went.
He worked for the Ward Baking Company up in Boston. So, I mean, we always ate bread, and we had the weirdest sandwiches.
Yeah.
Sure.
Like sugar and butter, mustard sandwich.
So nothing between the bread, but you had the bread.
And
that's because you had connections because your dad worked there, right?
Right.
Right. So you were talking about being proud, too proud. I heard you say that. And that's, in other words, and you were saying about how sending out the children to the truck. This truck, I imagine, came around once a week. Is that what happened?
Once a week.
Do you know what the procedure was? Would you say, I'm the Simmons family? Could we, and I'll say, okay, there's one bread. Well, how would they deal that out? Does anybody remember? It's okay, we can confess now.
Well, I don't remember. I think we had to say how many was in the family.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Did you know how many there were in the family?
15 children.
Yeah.
We used to walk uptown and get a wagon full of food, but she was proud. She hated to do it.
Sure, but she had 15 children.
Yeah.
15
children. Folks never went to get it. They sent me You take your cart, go down to town hall, give them your name, and they'll put stuff in the cart.
Yeah. And we usually get that.
And usually it was rice and sweet potatoes. They were famous for sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
And you'd color lard and put it on your bread? Is that what you do? It's oleo, okay.
You have to mix it by hand.
Tell me about meat. Was it a treat or what? How did you get around a meatless society for all intent and purpose? Because there was no meat. All the cattle died.
Well, we had chickens.
Most everybody had chickens.
Almost everybody had chickens in their backyard.
Really?
Or a pig. Yeah. Or a pig.
A chicken or a pig in your backyard?
Yeah.
We had a farm.
I
never had to go without food like so many. Because I lived on a big farm. And so we had vegetables and pigs.
Yeah, we had a garden too.
Everybody had a garden.
Yeah.
You don't ever remember going hungry. Okay. Does anybody ever remember going hungry?
No, not really.
Wow. Look at that.
We had chickens, pigs,
sometimes
rabbits.
You didn't have much choice, but you never went hungry.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had something to eat.
But chickens, you had beef, was very rare, wasn't it?
But you know,
you never said, I ain't going to eat that.
No. Oh, no.
Put
on the table, you ate it.
You ate it.
The hamburger and the hot dogs, 2 pounds for a quarter.
Wow.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, my mother and I used to split it because we'd have one of those ice chests.
Oh,
yeah. And of course, you couldn't buy a whole lot of stuff because it wouldn't last.
It would spoil.
We eat a lot of fish.
But,
eat a lot of fish.
2 pounds for a quarter.
There's a lot of fish available.
Fish that was pulled out.
Not much meat. Right. Either got chicken or fish.
But today, the mothers will say, what do you want for dinner? When we were kids, the dinner was put on the table. You either ate it or you were never going to ask.
And you got the same thing every week at the same
that
day.
Was
you're
it.
Right,
that was
problems.
It. You ate it. You were
you
hungry.
You knew it was going to be a dinner. Wow.
I always had beans and franks on Saturday. Always.
Because they baked the beans.
I heard you say you didn't like beans as a kid, but you love them now.
Is that what you said? Yes.
Yeah.
Same here. I didn't like them, but I love them too. Like French and beans. That's an American meal on a Saturday.
My father used to go work for a guy to help him hay during the summer, and we'd get milk almost all year round. Plus, you might get a piece of pork if you killed this pig.
Okay.
And you know, that's what you did. You gave something to get something.
Yeah, you're part of it.
You did a lot of that.
Yeah. What about fruit? You had a lot of fruit here, obviously. Apples, right? Everybody told that I talked about the Great Depression in New England. Everybody had apples. That was a main staple of the diet. Staple of
brown
diet.
Worms.
I think that my memories of the Depression was friends over here, and I were in high school between 31 and 35. Those were the tough years.
Tell me about that in high school, for instance.
We all wore the same thing all the time. I know.
Right. Oh, God. One dress all year.
And my mother made clothes out of. In those days, they had grain bags.
We used the
grain bags. She bought, open them up and wash them, make clothes with them. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any.
And the curtains in the kitchen would be the same.
Fortunately, they put out different colored grain bags, or all the girls in school would have looked the same.
If you only had one color grain bag, all the girls would look the same.
May I ask you who had a car, or who knew somebody that had a car, and tell me what the feeling was when you knew somebody or a family had a car? Did everybody have a car? Tell me about that, please.
We did.
My father had a Durant.
Did you
hear that? A
Durant.
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember that it was green.
Yeah.
We were like a lot of people. We had a car, but it was in the backyard, jacked up. I never saw it run.
Yeah.
Well, then you had to crank.
We used to play it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was an old Essex.
Wow.
We used to play it, but I never saw it on the road.
My grandfather always had a
car. My father had a dump truck.
Yeah, dump truck.
And I had
some people did.
In high school, we were having a concert with a chorus, and we had to wear a long dress. And that was my first long dress, my first heels, and nylons.
Wow.
And
oh, wow.
That
oh, my
was a
goodness.
Big trick. And then I had to go to the concert in the dump truck.
So clothing was tough, and shopping, I mean, when you probably hand-me-downs. I come from one of seven, and I lived in hand-me-downs, but it was nothing like
Cinderella rode in a pumpkin.
Yeah. And people tried to hide, the wealthy tried to hide themselves as being wealthy. Is that correct? You really didn't know who was wealthy and who was poor?
You saw it in Newburyport very much.
Oh, okay.
From
very clean.
The high streeters.
Oh, really?
To anywhere else in the city.
Okay.
And Bossy Gillis would always look
the
high streeters.
He was the mayor.
Very, very much.
Sir, you said if it wasn't for the WPA, you wouldn't have nothing. Elaborate on that, please.
Well, your father, they'd find enough work for maybe a couple days, and everybody gets the same amount every week. But you would work a few days, and then somebody else would turn to work. Mm-hmm. But then you'd probably get $12 a week or something.
Exactly.
Got you by.
Yeah, just enough to get by.
Did you go cold?
Yeah.
Did you go cold in terms of your house, or was it just you had fireplaces? We didn't have these oil burners, did we, back in the 30s? We had fireplaces.
You had a
cold
stove.
Cold stove in the kitchen. Going all
the
time.
They used to pay my father to go out into the town woods and cut wood all day. Because that's what people were burning. You know, they would go to the town and say they didn't have no heat, and the town would give them wood to burn. And my father would cut wood all week and make money that way when winter was coming.
And they paid $3 a cord in those days.
That's right.
Cutting wood for $3 a cord.
And
remember my two kids. They
no matter what you got, in one way or another, you're going to pay
with their little red
even if it was labor or something.
And they pick up coal that was washed ashore.
Okay, they picked up coal that was washed ashore. And I'm sure any coal that fell off a train, too, that went by, right?
Yeah. And when that burned, it used to throw off beautiful colors from the salt, I guess, that was on the
From the coal, really?
Yeah, it was very pretty.
Yeah, now in terms of heating your house, and you didn't travel much, obviously, because you had to travel by foot or by bicycle. Did y'all have bicycles?
No, not all of us. We walked.
We
always
walked.
25
minutes.
Most of the time, I rode around with tires on it.
And used to wear it all
the time. Put a four tires.
Yeah.
And I remember him and my father.
On a rim.
He rolled up some newspaper once again. Because I had him all on my shoe and he couldn't get my any shoe. So he put that in so my foot wouldn't get wet.
Tin can covers in the shoes. Remember when the soles would wear through? And they take a tin can cover and cover the hole.
Wow.
And put it, you know, the insole back.
Inside your shoe?
Yeah, my father used to put newspaper wrap, roll up.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, did you grow right away?
Did you grow gardens, not Victory Gardens, but gardens, vegetable gardens? Did y'all have one in your backyard? Oh,
sure. That was during,
not everybody had a
that was during the war.
Yeah.
See, not going back, are you? When I was reading about that, the Great Depression, did you see a lot of eerie correlations of where we are today, what you've been hearing about the government people and speculating and all this, and they speculated in their houses and went house jumping and got themselves an incredible amount of debt, thinking the times would be more prosperous, whereas I'm sure I'm sitting around a table of mostly conservative people that had seen it, seen the bad times, and always in the back of your mind, you thought, we might get back to that day. That's and let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that day is coming.
Oh, no. We know that, but the kids, these
they don't. They don't understand. They don't understand.
Years ago, nobody sat around waiting for the government to send you money or do anything like that.
There were no stipends.
They didn't expect the government to bail you out. Today, I think people really expect the government, it's their duty to bail them out.
And they haven't got the
no
money.
No matter how far in debt they are.
They
expect the government to bail them out. Back in the Depression, nobody sat around waiting for the government.
Well, the 1930s in New England were extra tough because the Red Sox were so bad. Although they got this Sponge Splinter show up in 1936, this mildly thin guy from San Diego, and Ted Williams being the greatest hitter that ever lived.
Ted Williams was great.
He's the first one I remember.
Yeah,
sure.
I love Ted Williams.
So what did you do for entertainment? Tell me about your... In your teens, it's Friday night. What's the entertainment to do, or do you keep yourself busy? Do your parents?
All you have is a radio for them.
Well, you know, if you mentioned Dillinger, sir. Bonnie and Clyde were folk heroes. Tell me about that you remember, because people hated bankers more than they hated bank robbers.
That's right.
Wow.
They hated the bank more than they did the robbers.
They had the money.
They were mad at the banks.
Yeah. And did y'all have radios?
Hey,
we all had a radio.
Y'all had a radio? Everybody? You had access to radio?
And we'd sit there and picture, you know, just what was happening. I remember my father used to rush home from work so he could listen to Amos and Andy.
Amos and Andy, okay. Yeah. Yep. What other ones? Flash Gordon? Fibber and McGee, is it?
Fibber McGee. The old Wrangler.
The Mystery Theater.
The Mystery Theater, okay.
What was it, the Green Hornet or
the
something?
Green, yes, yeah, okay.
I can remember my father listening to Joe Louis fighting on the radio.
Joe Louis fighting on the radio.
On the radio.
Wow. I love to hear that,
yeah. We used to sit there on the floor right around the radio and we'd all listen to the fight.
Did he make you listen to FDR? Were you forced to listen to FDR's chats and did you look forward to them?
Yeah,
we all listened to that.
A source of hope, maybe, perhaps? Was there a sense of hope that things are going to get better?
Yeah, that was one of the things we liked doing.
You just sit there and look at the speaker. I don't know why.
I know it.
Fireside chat.
Fireside chat.
I remember FDR's speech when he declared war. They brought all the kids in the auditorium at the high school to hear that speech.
Really? December 9th, I believe.
Yep.
Wow.
The WPA
built
a beautiful new...
I remember listening to the fights, and one big championship fight, I forget who it was now, but anyway, I went in the kitchen to get a chair so I could get closer, and by the time I got back, the fight was over. They got knocked out in the first round.
I've been there, that happened much later in life for me when I bring out the pizza and the fight's over. So, may I ask about aircraft? This is great, by the way. I'm deviating from my lecture. I'm just going to chat. We're going to chat because we're having much more fun than we usually do. Let me ask you about aircraft. Does anybody recall any dirigibles like the Akron, the Los Angeles, or the Hindenburg? Can you tell me that, please? I'm an aviation historian.
I remember when the Hindenburg, I was interested in watching that. And I was the only place you'd see something.
May 6, 1937, that's when it crashed.
In the movie theater, the newsreel.
Yep.
And when I saw that blow up. Oh, that was awful.
May 6, 1937. Does anybody remember seeing any dirigibles fly overhead during the 1930s?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, you're acting like it's normal occurrence. Tell me about it, please.
The people would wave to us. We were just little kids, and we'd run out in the yard to see it. And I can remember seeing the people wave to us.
Wow. Do you remember which one it was? Was it the Macon?
No,
the,
I don't remember.
Yeah, the Graf Zeppelin. Yeah.
I don't know. I remember we used to run out if we hear a plane. Planes first started. Run out and see this little plane flying over.
Fly over.
I know it was fantastic.
Double wing.
One engine.
Does anybody remember their parents talking about the day the stock market crashed? Does anybody remember late October 29 into the first week of November 29? Can you tell me about that, please?
They didn't know anybody in the stock market.
You're saying, you're all, could you say that again, please?
I had knuckle that lost all his money. He was in line to get his money and the bank closed.
He was in line to get his money and the bank closed.
Wow.
Wow. Does anybody else remember anything?
I was with my father going up to Ainsley to the bank. He was going to borrow money to buy a horse. And got up there and it was closed.
Wow.
And that was, I remember how upset he was because I was young enough not to understand it, only that I know I was with him.
Sure.
He closed the bank, what, for 3-4 days, a week or what?
No, it was only a day.
A bank holiday.
Or just one day? I didn't know.
A bank holiday?
No, I think she did.
It was that they closed it one day a week, one extra day a week?
I know they closed the bank.
It was 3 or 4 days in succession.
To stop a run on it, yeah. I thought it was 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, I think so.
May I ask you now, in the 32 and 33 was the, they call it the trough, the worst years of the Depression. Do you remember the direst times? Did you hear your parents get destitute or saying, this is horrible? Where they were losing hope. Did you ever get to that point where you lost hope?
I never heard of my parents saying anything.
We didn't have any coal. We were kids. My father had a lot of woodland. He got wood, but he sold it all the time. So we always ended up with greenwood to burn. And it was, we moved practically into the kitchen, and the bedrooms weren't heated anymore. And I lived in a fairly new house. It was built in 14, so it had radiators and a bathroom and things when a lot of people didn't have.
Bathroom? What's a bathroom?
Can I ask you, do you remember the hot summers of 1934, 35, and 36?
Yeah.
Do you remember that? And I know there was a major flood in 36. People forget about that. That flooded out the whole Connecticut River Valley. Does anybody have any recollections of that time period, middle 30s, and how hot the summers were?
I remember the flood. My dad took me up to Haverhill. And we could watch the buildings and everything coming down the river. And getting tied up at the the Bates Bridge. The water was running right over the deck of the bridge.
Let me tell you,
all kinds of stuff up there. They've got a house up there now with a sign on it, how high the water was.
Right. And they were taking stuff out of the post office and rowboats in Haverhill. I remember watching that.
Can I ask you, do you remember hearing about Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass in Germany, and this madman called Hitler in the 30s? Do you remember hearing anything about it, or was it not until he invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939, when Chamberlain came back?
All the magazines at the time had articles on Hitler and his youth movement. All the children being in big groups and being militarized. And they were saying things with Italy. Mussolini. They all had groups of children beginning to get in the army. Little kids.
Yeah.
I remember all that about the wars. Then my brothers all enlisted.
May I ask you, does anybody tell me about the hurricane in 1938? We're staying in the
30s. Would you like to know?
No. Tell me
a good story. Who's got a good one? You didn't know it was a hurricane because nobody was warned.
We didn't even know what it was.
Right. Did you know what happened at the Weather Bureau? Right, because the Weather Bureau, a young man by the name of Charles Pierce, 28 years old, was filling in as a weather reporter at the Weather Bureau. He said the hurricane's going to hit New York and New England, and he was scoffed at.
And they never did.
Never had one up here.
Exactly.
What was his name?
Never had.
Exactly. No, it would never happen either.
What was the guy that predicted it? His name was Wright something.
Charles Pierce.
No.
I was working at Raytheon.
No.
And the when radio I came guy. Out of Raytheon, I had to walk across a small bridge over the Charles River. And I had an umbrella because it was pouring. And so my umbrella went way downriver, inside out. And then I got home and there wasn't any power or anything for 2 weeks, over 2 weeks. And all the trees down and everything.
2 billion trees.
Then I found out we had a hurricane.
Yeah. Does anybody else remember?
I was working in Hudson Street, Pittsburgh, and the unitary church can use that with a steeple swaying with a strong.
Thank
you. He went down to Plum Island to secure the boat. And the sand, he used to hide sandblast the car. So then, had to have it all done.
Huh. And finally, before we leave here this morning, does anybody remember hearing in 1938, Orson Welles, October, the War of the Worlds broadcast? Tell me about that. What do you remember as a child or as a youth?
I remember my mother being frightened.
That very night, she was frightened.
And we heard it on the radio.
You heard it, yep.
And that's all I remember. Wow. And I kept... Well, I wasn't the type to get frightened. I was kind of curious.
Sure, certainly.
But I remember my mother being frightened.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with all of you. I hope you have a good summer. And hopefully we will have a summer. And thank you and God bless. Thank you.
Thank you.